You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com, brought to you by the Beautiful Game Network, Roughneck Scarves, and Icarus FC. It is Friday, December 4th, 2020. The MLS Cup playoffs conference semifinals are in the books. The conference finals are upon us, and MLS Cup is less than 10 days away. We've got a fantastic show for you tonight, talking about a lot of things, but first, let me bring in my co-host, Rachel Krieger. Rachel, how was Thanksgiving, and has the Christmas spirit arrived in the Krieger household?
Yeah, I set up the tree this evening, and for like the last 2 days at work, I have been setting up trees around, like I work at, basically it's like a college campus for retired people, in the main building. Yeah, Dan, seriously, it's nicer than where I went to college. it's like I set up like 5 or 6 Christmas trees, I think, in the last 2 days. So, you know, definitely the holiday spirit's coming. Thanksgiving was good. It was good. And in 2 weeks, boys, this girl has a master's degree. So, let's go. If I pass. You guys know very well that you
joined. Knock on wood, you'll pass.
If I pass, so I hope I didn't just curse myself.
Dan, I think we spoke a couple episodes ago. I think this was pre-Thanksgiving where you had already caved in with the wife and allowed her to set up Christmas stuff. Normally, I would be the person pointing out Bethany and a bunch of other people on my social media timelines about them being basic. That said, this is 2020. 2020 has robbed us of many things, unfortunately, and whatever small joy you can get. Mm-hmm. And if that means Christmas creep starting on Halloween, then I'm not going to judge you for it. But in any case, Dan, has that, how was Thanksgiving, and has that descended upon House Barry?
Yeah, tonight we went and took a quick road trip to Dairy Queen. And Bethany was surprised that I started blaring Christmas music in the car on our way there. Mainly it was to help somehow make the baby happy and stop screaming, because in the car as we were driving there, she literally had a tooth come through. And so it was like all hell breaking loose in the back seat while like Mariah Carey is like going to town. Actually, the crazy thing, last night at the end of the Sporting Kansas City, and so Walmart is doing this drone light show in 8 cities across the United States. So they were, it is staged in the parking lot that both Children's Mercy Park and the Kansas Speedway share. It's in between both venues. It's a big, long, drag parking lot. And then the drones and their whole setup is supposed to be over the raceway, but you can see it from there. So it's this drone light show. And they had big old, like, TV screens and massive, like stereo tower stacks and stuff, like, hanging from big rigs and all this stuff. When I got into the game, I thought it was just like they had a screen set. It was gonna be like a drive-in watch party, like San Jose earthquake style, and everyone's gonna honk when they score, like the people who couldn't be in the stadium. But as we're walking out, this is like 10:30 at night, and if those of you who know Kansas City geography, like the raceway and Sporting Park is like the last bit of civilization between Kansas City and Denver, and so along I-70, and so like stands Topeka for about like 2 minutes. Like it's pretty much the last bit of real civilization at that point. And so we're walking out. I was walking with one of the interns and another reporter, and we're walking up the street, and all of a sudden out of the freaking sky is like a giant like Christmas tree, and then Frosty the Snowman and Mariah Carey came on like blaring loud from this drone light show that was they were doing the prep run for, and nobody knew anything about it. And so like it was the trippiest thing to go through and hear like some like hip hop version of dreidel 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 and all this other crap going on, like, and we're just standing there. Like I have video of it, and I'll put it on Twitter later tonight, but like I literally, I was so tripped out. I have never done any, like, hallucinogenic drug before in my life. That's never been my thing. However, I imagine that's what it has to be like when you're high. Because, like, seriously, I'm trying to pull out of the parking lot, and I'm freezing my butt off. But all I can see is this giant dancing Christmas tree and Frosty the Snowman jamming out to Mariah Carey. And it was really, really, really... So Christmas spirit is in full swing around here, let me tell you.
I'm going to assume, Dan, that then you were possessed by the ghost of Christmas It's Lit.
That's how it felt, dude. There was some hip-hop in there, rolled out like a little tape deck with like smiling faces on it. And that's where I was like, okay, this is really trippy. Like... The turntables had like smiley faces, and we're rapping along with DMX or not DMX. Run DMC. There it is.
Run DMC. Okay. Let's return our attention and our focus to something that was a little bit more sane, I guess, and that was the MLS Cup playoffs. We will start chronologically with all of the conference semifinal games. So, Dan, we will start going back this past Sunday, almost 6 days ago now, at time of recording, Orlando City hosting the New England Revolution and Orlando Chaos, but also the big guns for New England get the job done.
Yeah, man. It was a tribute from Gustavo Bo to Diego Maradona in the best way possible. We'll keep that theme going with Argentines balling out after making a tribute to Maradona. Gustavo Bo got on the end of two of the goals for New England. New England, again, Tajon Buchanan earned a penalty kick. Carlos Gil slotted it away. Another very lightning fast counterattack, after turning counter pressing and turning someone over, for New England worked. Made a very nice counterattack. Actually a very good save by Brian Rowe initially on the play. However, was not saved by Brian Rowe. He did not do well that game. That's what it was. Ball came off the post, rebound, and Brian Rowe, as those of you who know Brian Rowe, or, like, have seen him around MLS, he's one of the smaller goalkeepers. I have to imagine Gaiacy's long octopus arms would have gotten to that ball and kept it away from Gustavo Bo's foot, but alas, they did not. And that's why Matt's over here in my video stream waving his arms like an octopus.
I'm Octopus I'm a troublesome octopus person.
Guy AC's nickname is El Pupo, which is the octopus, right? So, like, if you didn't know that, like, that's legitimately kind of why I said that. But Guy AC would have been able to get to that ball. Gustavo Bo got there and said it slammed it home. Orlando got one back on a terrible play from Matt Turner. And then later on, Matias Pereira from Orlando City put in a shocking two-footed tackle, jumping, lunging, leg extended, raked the calf of Matt Polster in easy straight red. Luis Nani was lucky to not get sent off for grabbing referee Alex Chilowitz multiple times. I thought the referee managed the chaos and the game really well. He did a good job of dishing out cards when necessary. I will do my best to praise pro referees as much as I drag them for the crap that happened between Orlando City and New York City. I thought Chilowitz did a really good job of handling a very high intensity and very hotly tempered Orlando City squad in that match. Orlando did have a chance at 2-1 to level it with a penalty kick while they were down a man. However, it was a pretty terrible penalty kick from Nani and a very good, well-read, comfortable save for Matt Turner, who kind of remedied his mistake that led to the goal for them in the first half. And then Gustavo Bo put one away from a wonderful little through ball from Carlos Gil to make it 3-1 close to the end of the match and put it away. So it was a comfortable win from New England. I think not necessarily comfortable in the sense of, like, you know, they were up 3-0 and Orlando got one back late. It was comfortable, and I don't think Orlando was too amped up to create, like, really cohesive quality chances, and they were just relying. It seemed like they were just relying on the ability to get on the end of the chaos. And New England was just kind of like the dude that's just staring down, like, the bull coming at him with the flag, and they're just, like, ready, like, all right, the bull's pissed and angry and charging right at him, but the dude with the flag knows, hey, man, I'm just going to take it out of the way, and you don't get it, you're good, jump out of the way, like that. That's how it felt. With New England kind of just playing with Orlando as Orlando was playing through emotions. It was a good a good, strong, complete performance from New England in Orlando for that one.
I think it's well said, Dan, that, you know, a Bruce Arena coach team is anti-chaos, and so chaos is a ladder when chaos is able to take over, and Bruce Arena doesn't allow chaos to take over most of the time, I should say.
Most of the time.
Let us move on to the nightcap that we had on Sunday, November the 29th, and that was Columbus Crew taking on the expansion team, Nashville SC. This game required extra time as it was 0-0 after 90 minutes, and then it was a 99-minute goal from Pedro Santos with the assist from Giassi's artist and Lucas De La Rion for a really good, we could call it a tic-tac-toe, tiki-taka counterattack, and a good finish by Pedro Santos. And then Giassi's artist on the counterattack, with a great prototypical for him run and finish into open space. It has been a part of the Caleb Porter, and then even going back to the Greg Berhalter era. I remember a quote from Giassi's artist when Berhalter had initially, after his first year, and they kind of said, you know, if the system is working, I'm getting tap-ins, or I'm getting goals that look relatively easy, rather than him having to do a great finish. And that was very much the second goal that came in the 103rd minute. So this game was kind of a war of attrition. You know, everybody knew that Nashville was going to come in and they were going to defend. They had a couple good opportunities on counterattacks. I would say, you know, against Inter Miami, Miami just didn't have any venom in their attack whatsoever. So it was just about waiting for Miami to give up the ball or make a mistake to then open things up. But it was very much kind of ironic in that Nashville didn't dominate possession, but they dominated chances, and ultimately in that it was one-way traffic, even though most of the time it was Miami building out of their back trying to get into the Nashville final third. This was a little bit more even in terms of Columbus having more of the ball, but then Nashville creating a lot of good counterattacking opportunities. The shots ended up being 17-17 each through the 120 minutes, and then four on target for a team. Obviously, the two goals for Columbus, and then obviously none of the four shots on target were scored for Nashville. But so this was, I think it was a good test for Columbus in that it was a team that was resolute, that executed, but ultimately it just came down to, was there going to be one or two mistake where Nashville was operating at 87% of what they usually are, as opposed to being at 95%+, and then ultimately Columbus's quality ended up showing up, and we saw that I think most of the season when their three main players were healthy, Pedro Santos, Giassi's artist, Lucas El Aran, and we saw this definitely in the playoff game, despite the scoreline against New York Red Bulls, it was a 3-2 win for Columbus in there. And so in that, it was about what I was expected. I would have expected, and if Columbus wants to consider themselves, you know, a major contender for winning MLS Cup, I think they have to finish off this team in 90 minutes. But the back line got tested, and Jonathan Mensah stood up and did a really good job. I thought Tarbell was fantastic, in goal with Romy Loom unavailable for that game, playing all 120 minutes. So Columbus is looking decent, and they have the same attacking core. And if those three guys are clicking on all cylinders and combining well with each other, they will be able to compete with any of the other three teams left in the playoffs. Let us move over to the Western Conference. We will start chronologically. Rachel, 1-0 Seattle versus Dallas. Dallas comes in, is really pragmatic, does all their things to frustrate Dallas, and ultimately it was just a matter of were they going to be able to get something against the run of play, or was the dam inevitably going to break? And the dam broke, and the Sounders did what they do in the playoffs.
Yeah, and it came from the most unlikely source of it all, Shane O'Neill. With Javier Arriaga coming back from Ecuador, they had him quarantined for the, I think it was like 10 or 14 days. He was in training, and he didn't even sub into the match. They just let Shane O'Neill go off. And it was poor marking from FC Dallas. But FC Dallas really didn't have much in the attack either. I think they had like 9 or 10 shots and nothing on goal. So Stefan Fry didn't really have a super busy night. I thought Shane O'Neill and Yaimar Gomez Andrade looked really good as the center back pairing, although I do think that Javier Arriaga will probably get the start over Minnesota. But you never know, because Schmetzer's pretty high on Shane O'Neill. And this was the second game in a row, too, where Alex Roldan got the start at right back with Kelvin Leardom coming off of a hamstring injury. Leardom did come in the game in the second half. I don't remember the exact time, but it was good to see him back. But not too much happening with the, you know, with the power front three with Raul Ruiz Diaz, Jordan Morris, and Nico Lodero. I think Nico Lodero out of the three probably looked the best. Ruiz Diaz and Jordan Morris just really couldn't get anything going. And like I said, the unlikely hero was Shane O'Neill. I think FC Dallas came in there with the game plan of just trying to get Seattle off of their game. And I think they did disrupt, and they did obviously keep Jordan Morris, Ruiz Diaz, and Nico Lodero contained pretty well. But they kind of just forgot about some of the others. And Seattle's a really good team on set piece plays. I think that that's one of their strong suits, especially on corner kicks. So Seattle gets the win 1-0 and a fourth Western Conference final in the last 5 years is pretty special, pretty exciting.
Just one confirmation there for you, Rachel. Kelvin Leardam subbing in for Tuna Jones in the 68th minute. So you were right in him getting, I guess, 21 minutes plus whatever stoppage time was. One follow-up question for you. I mean, we've seen, I remember the Rapids versus Seattle game in the final week or two of the regular season where Colorado got a 3-1 win and did some similar things. We saw Lucci Gonzalez in the media talk about how things just didn't work with his approach in the playoffs last year, and so they went to be a little bit more pragmatic. And so this was kind of this game and the tactics behind it were kind of a iterative improvement off of what they did to stymie Portland Timbers. Is there any concern for you that either this is now the blueprint that Minnesota could use to beat Seattle, or was this more just about Jordan Morris, Raul Ruiz Diaz, and to a lesser extent, Nico Lodero just not executing on the evening?
No, I think FC Dallas had the right game plan. Come in and, you know, not, I guess not single out, but like group up on Jordan Morris, Raul Ruiz Diaz, and Nico Lodero, because, I mean, that's really the bread and butter of your attack, right? So you neutralize those guys, the odds are that it's going to be scrappy. It's going to be hard for Seattle to get a goal. And listen, if Shane O'Neill wasn't huge and couldn't, and was, it, I mean, if FC Dallas was properly marking on the play where Shane O'Neill scored, I think that game would have gone into extra time and then maybe penalty kicks. But FC Dallas just kind of had this like lapse in judgment. I don't know what was going on there, and they didn't mark up, and they, and Shane O'Neill scored. So no, I think Minnesota's going to look at what FC Dallas did in terms of keeping those front three players kind of neutralized. But then at the same time, not to preview too much because I know we're going to get there, but, you know, you're neutralizing those guys, well, then you're forgetting. I mean, Seattle's a really deep and just downright talented team. You got Jovan Jones, who can play literally everywhere on the pitch, probably goalkeeper too, because what the heck. You've got him as the right attacker, and then you've got Christian Roldan right behind, and Joao Paulo, because Joao Paulo can score too. So I think it's FC Dallas had the right plan, but I don't know if Minnesota. Can they neutralize those front three players? Yes. Can they neutralize all 10 field players? I don't know about that.
We'll move on to the final game of the conference semifinals. Dan, Sporting Kansas City and Minnesota United played in Blue Hell, and Blue Hell was left iced over, Ice Walker style. What the hell happened?
Dude, this game was wild. The first 20 minutes was all Sporting Kansas City. At the end of the night, Sporting Kansas City still ended with a higher expected goals number than the Minnesota United Loons. However, I think there's a couple of key turning points in this moment for me. One, it happens right as Dane St. Clair makes an incredible save on the line to keep Roberto Punchets out. At that point, that was about Sporting's fourth clear-cut goal-scoring chance in the first 20 minutes of that game. Granted, there was a good save that Dane made on a 1v1. Boxall cleared one off the line. But in terms of clear-cut chances, Sporting Kansas City should have been up 2-0 at the point that Kevin Molino scored his first goal. And at that point, it felt like that goal just kind of made Sporting capitulate, and Minnesota got on a roll. For a while, Bibolo Reynoso had not been really even involved. He hadn't been successful in anything. Sporting also were carrying a lot of yellow cards going into this game. I think they were a little too worried about potentially getting suspended for a Western Conference final and weren't really willing to put in tackles on players. You could see it as players were kind of pulling up in 50-50 challenges to try and not get that foul, get that yellow card drawn. However, it's Drew Fisher. He's never going to hand out a yellow card unless somebody spears somebody with a fishing pole that someone pulls out of their rear end on the sideline. So, Drew Fisher's the least.
There's an alternate universe where Kai Kamara did that on Sunday, just to be fair.
True. So, exactly. But Drew Fisher's not going to yellow card you, man. I mean, I don't think it took Minnesota 10 fouls to get one yellow card. And most of them were incredibly petulant, stopping of the transition that Drew Fisher barely blew his whistle, pointed and said, all right, let's go, take the free kick, get the game going, kind of a thing. That's Drew Fisher. And so I think Sporting should have kind of taken that into account a little bit. But Kevin Molino and Bibolo Reynoso hooked up twice in a span of about 10 minutes. Both of them threw balls in between the central channels of Sporting Kansas City's defense. This was not around the outside where Sporting Kansas City had been giving up a lot of goals and then chose to kind of make themselves a little bit more compact towards the end of the season. Minnesota did a good job of trying to spread them out a little bit, and when they had numbers forward, they attacked the central channels, and it worked. And Reynoso found Molino on a couple of through balls when Sporting Kansas City was pulled all out of shape. And then the other one was they didn't jump the line when they should have. One time the line was too high for the first goal. The second goal, the line wasn't high enough to pull Kevin Molino offside. And then the third one, a little bit controversial. It was offside in the build-up play that the AR chose not to call. Goes out for a corner kick. Corner kick headed in by the Bossy to make it 3-0. That pretty much was the nail in the coffin for Sporting Kansas City. Yes, sure, Minnesota scored 3 goals in a span of 12 minutes. Sporting Kansas City had 45 minutes to, chip away at the lead. But they're without Alan Pulido. They were without their true number 10 and starting best midfielder all season in Felipe Gutierrez. And then the other guy that they spent a crap ton of money on in the midfield and got Akinda only played about 30 minutes because he's coming back from injury. So boil it down to this. The Minnesota United Loons had all of their DPs and all their best players possible out on the field that night. Sporting Kansas City didn't. Minnesota won 3-0. And I think you have a little bit of different quality for Sporting Kansas City on the field. I think, one, those chances get put away, and two, there's a lot more ways to try and score goals in that second half for Sporting Kansas City to maybe come back. I definitely think if Sporting gets one of those first goals, the game ends up differently than that score line. But they didn't. Molino shredded them, and it was hot boy dancing his way through Children's Mercy Park to get that victory, and a very big victory for Minnesota United. First time they've ever won in Kansas City last night.
One follow-up question here, Dan. Here at Last Word SC Radio, we try to be as intelligent as we can, but I think understandably so, if we're talking about the narrative of snubbery or of doubt towards Sporting Kansas City because they don't, at least historically, haven't spent as much money as some of the other big powers in the Western Conference. I look at their playoffs and I see them, barely skate by against against the San Jose Earthquakes team, who ended up being the last seed in the playoffs in the Western Conference, and I see them, lose emphatically in the scoreline. You mentioned a bunch of good points where, kind of similar to the game against Colorado, this was a game of 7-10 moments, and it was about who was going to make a play defensively at the goalkeeper position versus who was going to finish off the opportunity, and it just so happened in those 7-10 moments, Minnesota were overwhelmingly better than Sporting Kansas City was. Is there any, do you put any credibility on the narrative of people doubting or forgetting Sporting Kansas City because of the performance behind the win over San Jose, the fact that they lost now to Minnesota, and even though they spent big money, those were players who were, unavailable for various reasons, but, nonetheless not available in crunch time, which has been, regardless of what's going on in June and July, Nicolò Darò shines in October, November, and the first weekend in December.
Yeah, and I think that's a valid thing too. I think it's harsh on Sporting to not be able to pull out Alan Pulido and Felipe Gutierrez all season long. And I would say for those critics, you know, if you have watched anything Sporting I don't think you criticize them at all if you've watched any bit of Sporting Kansas City this season. But if you have watched any bit of Sporting Kansas City this season, you know they're two very different teams. When Alan Pulido is on the field and when he's not, they are a significantly better attacking team just because of the gravity of Alan Pulido, but also the things that he can do. And it gives them, like I said, it gives them more build-up options. Their only option in that second half was to get the ball wide and try and cross it to Kyrie Shelton or Eric Hurtado and, you know, maybe get Johnny Russell to dribble through a few guys. That was their entire game plan almost all night long. They had nothing that they could really build through the middle. And, you know, I do think a lot more credit needs to be given to the Loons. For a majority of their season, they did not have Miguel Reynoso to ball out as a playmaker that way he does. For a majority of the season, they were relying on freaking Aaron Schoenfeld as a striker until they decided to put Robin Ludd as a bit of a false nine and help pull out all the go with a very fluid front four and pull the defenses out of position to find the creases so you could get to the runners like Finley and Molino and Laud in behind. So, you know, this is a – if you've watched Sporting Kansas City all season, you know that performance against San Jose was a good performance. If you've watched San Jose, you know that's a pretty darn good team despite some of those losses that they were at. So I think the critics are critics, sure, but, you know, there's only about – at this point, there's only four teams that are really sitting that have gone further than Sporting Kansas City, and I'd say most of those critics are people who don't come from those four quote households of fandom. So, you know, I hear the critics, but at the same time, they finished top of the West in a pandemic-ridden season. They were one of the more healthier teams when it came to COVID. They never had to have games canceled because of their own stuff. Because of their problems, it was because of the opponents. They, for a while, were able to take care of business without Pulido, but they ran into a very good team and a very hot team in Minnesota United at the wrong time without Pulido and without some of their stars, and it cost them. And I think, you know, ultimately, there's a really good quote I saw on Twitter, and I'll kind of finish with this. You know, homegrowns and the homegrown depth and all of that can win you a supporter shield. But having the best DPs on the field is what's going to win you MLS Cup. When you're in those one-off games, having your three best players and having them be better than your other team's three best players are what's going to carry you through. And Sporting didn't have theirs. Minnesota did. And I think that was the difference in the finishing of those chances and stuff in that match.
Good stuff there, Dan. Let us move on to the conference final preview. We will start. We've got the Eastern Conference final this coming Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern on ABC, Big ABC. Columbus Crew hosting the New England Revolution. We'll start with the visitors. Dan, I will throw it to you first. Give me the perspective on New England. What are they looking at in terms of matching up against the Columbus Crew? What little tactical personnel nuances could we see from Bruce Arena, and just generally, how are the Revs feeling going into this match? We're kind of, again, understandably, they're underdogs, but in a good position based on how they've played and the tactics of the coaching staff to go and get another result on the road.
Yeah, I actually kind of like this matchup for New England, the way New England's been playing, and they've kind of played a couple of very similar teams. I wouldn't say Montreal is similar, but in their defeat of Philadelphia and their defeat of Orlando, they've played some similar teams that when they're at home, they really like to be on the front foot. Caleb Porter, when he's at home, likes to play the attacking soccer. They like to have possession and like to try and dominate you. There's a big difference there, I think, in the quality of New England in the final third in Nashville. In the final third in Nashville, was able to take Columbus to the ropes in that game and at least get them to overtime. And I know it was two goals for Columbus late to get it done. They finally wore down the Nashville United. But this New England team is a team that's going to be a pain on the counter for them to deal with, and it's going to be just maybe not as good, but strong enough defensively that I think this could cause some problems for Columbus. I think this is the best team that they've faced so far in the playoffs, and it's going to be, if you're New England, I think you're kind of licking your chops at this match, knowing that Columbus is going to be at home, they're going to try and be on the front foot, and you're sitting there saying, all right, Tajon Buchanan, going to burn in behind, we're going to have Carlos Gil pulling the strings. I don't think the center back pairing I'd argue that I like Orlando's back line more than I like Columbus's. And I think if there's any true weak point for Columbus, it is their back line. So I think this is a match that if you're New England, you're kind of licking your chops at. But I don't think you change anything. You do what you've been doing. And I think, as you said, Bruce kind of manages the chaos really well. And Caleb Porter sometimes gets his teams prepped for games like this. And that is a team that can run hot a little bit in Columbus. I think this New England squad just, like you said, they're kind of even keel. They get it. They understand when their moments are. And I'm looking forward to New England picking their chances to get forward against Columbus. But I think this is surprisingly a favorable matchup for New England. I'll let quickly end this thought on New England. They have Carlos Gil this season. The whole season, they're not an 8 seed. They're probably in the top 4 of the Eastern Conference. And I think you gotta not look at that seeding when it comes to New England. This is a well-coached team. A very strong team coming through.
I think this is a good matchup. I think both teams will go in feeling confident in this match. From a Columbus Crew standpoint, Dan, I think you're looking at it as an improved defensive performance. Certainly, there were a lot of really dangerous moments that Nashville had. Alex Mule on the wing, a couple good opportunities on set pieces. You know, not the dangerous, I'm not going to say world-class, but I guess we'll say on a scale-wise, like continental class quality you get from Gustavo Bo, Carlos Gil, and to a lesser extent, Buxa, compared to what you saw from the New York Red Bulls and the Nashville SC in the other two playoff games. But similar opportunities and similar tests that, you know, Jonathan Mensah has been able to stand up, and that back line's been able to deal with results, and certainly Artur also trying to, you know, gum up things in the midfield. And on the other side of things, I have to think that you look at the center back matchup against Yossi Zardes and think that that's a favorable opportunity, and think that if the outside backs are going to try to get up and actually create opportunities like they would in a, we'll say, a prototypical generic Bruce Arena system. So incorporating how he's coached at DC United, LA Galaxy, his national team stints, etc. And if they're more pinned back, then that's less numbers for your fullbacks, Harrison Afful, Jonathan Mensah, to then go and get forward. But so I think there'll be opportunities for both teams. I think both teams are going to, I think where the game ultimately is going to be decided is in the space for them centrally to then get the ball into space. So whether it's Gustavo Bo, Carlos Gil, Teal Bunbury, what are they doing in, you know, zone 10 or zone 13, right at the top of the box or inside the final third, to then create passing lanes and find gaps going forward. And then similar things for Lucas El Real, who I think is going to match up really well against Scotty Caldwell, and then Matt Polster being played slightly out of position. So I think both teams will come in feeling confident, feeling like defensively they'll be able to, it'll be a challenge in the test, but they'll be able to do good things and limit opportunities for the opponent, and they'll be able to find space in this one. I don't know, given how pragmatic Bruce can be, I don't know if this is going to be a game where I distinctly see New England, even as the lower seeded team, even as the team that is playing on the road, that we're going to see them necessarily bunker and counter. Whereas maybe, you know, New York Red Bulls, it was a little more chaos, and it was just a matter of Columbus dealing with that and then ultimately executing their game plan. With Nashville, it was distinctly them sitting back on the counter and letting Columbus have the ball. I think we're going to see a much more cat and mouse game in terms of tactics, in terms of who has the ball and when they have the ball and where they're able to find space. And in that, I think it's an even matchup. It could be set up for a really exciting conference final. This could also be a grungy, gritty, nil-nil, you know, people gumming it up, nobody wanting to lose it, kind of similar that we see from a final. Rachel, let me bring in you for our last bit that we'll talk about the conference finals, talking about key matchups or just a key thing that you're focusing on for the game. Is there anything that for you stands out?
Yeah, I think for me, the back line for Columbus definitely stands out. I think that if I think this is going to be the game that the team that gets the best counterattack is probably going to make the most of it, score, and kind of just ride the wave and claim their spot in the final. But I think I'm with Dan. If I'm New England, I don't really change anything. I kind of just roll with what we've got and what's been working. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I think for Columbus, they're a really fast team, I think. I think, like, Gustavo Bo is fast. There's no doubt about that. But I think that speed is primarily on the side of Columbus. And, you know, they're getting some players back from all of these COVID tests and restrictions and whatnot. So I think that's going to help. But I think they're in good hands, too. One of the things that I was most concerned about during their match against Nashville, gosh, I just blanked there for a minute, was Tarbell in goal. I was like, oh, well, you know, Eloy Room has been really, really good for them this year. What's going to happen with, you know, communicating with the defense and whatnot? Because you're so used to, you know, Eloy Room for the longest time. And I thought Tarbell did really well. I really thought he did a nice job against Nashville. He, you know, Nashville, when they got on the counter, they pressured him. And he did the job well, and he was able to make a few good saves. So I think that really whoever gets the best counterattack opportunity is probably going to win the game.
Dan, any key matchups or things that you're focusing on with this match?
I'm looking at the midfield battle there. You've got a much bigger midfield, or much better midfield in Columbus with Nagby, Artur, and Lucas Elorayan. However, Carlos Gil Co. in Matt Polster in that midfield there for the Revs kind of caused a lot of decent problems there. So I'm curious to see, it's going to be that midfield matchup. I think that is going to be the big winner. I think the forward line, you know, Gustavo Bo is a good goal scorer. So is Adam Buxa. We've got Pedro Santos and Jesse Zardes to be able to score goals outside of Zelarayan for Columbus. The back line's pretty even. Goalkeepers, both Eloy Room, if he's healthy and able to play in this game, and Matt Turner are good goalkeepers, very good goalkeepers. I think it's that midfield that I think is going to be the big win there. Whoever can win the midfield game, win the middle third of the field, I think is going to end up the winner in this matchup.
I look at Bruce Arena's teams when they've been at their best, and I could say this of the national team, I could say this of his LA Galaxy dynasty, I could say this of DC United's dynasty, and even at times in his brief tenure with the New England Revolution, they are at their best or most efficient or reaching their potential when they are able to win games 1-0. And in that, even though I think a lot of the keys for New England in terms of having success in this game are going to be their attacking three, in the same way that we could say it was Marco Echeverri, Jaime Moreno, and then a various, you know, third players in there for DC United, or, you know, Donovan, Keane, and at times Zardes, at times David Beckham. With the LA Galaxy, I think this is all about what can they do in order to limit them offensively. And so obviously I think it's going to be defense and pressure and maybe some tactical fouls by committee against Lucas Elorayan. I think he's done a fantastic job historically in dealing with fullbacks matching up against good outside wingers. So Pedro Santos in the way that he likes to attack versus a more direct Luis Diaz, for example. So I think the biggest key for them is cut off the main funnel point for all of their offensive chances, and that's Giassi Zardes. And so Bruce Arena was the head coach of the LA Galaxy when Giassi Zardes was signed as a homegrown, when Giassi Zardes scored in MLS Cup 2014 against the New England Revolution, and they've even had a little bit of overlap in the with the national team set up as well. So I don't know that there's another coach. Greg Berhalter would be the only one who remotely come close who understands Zardes, his tendencies, and where he fits in that system. So I would not be shocked at all if we see a Bruce tactical or at the very least preparation masterclass in terms of whether it's Andrew Farrell, whether it's Scott Codswell, to a lesser extent Kessler, maybe somebody else there on the back line, completely prepared, completely having a good understanding of Giassi Zardes' tendencies and being able to prevent them, almost like we were talking Dan, before we hit the record button, about people comparing Bruce Arena to Bill Belichick, and really in terms of what they achieved in their careers, Bruce Arena had already built a Hall of Fame resume prior to Bill Belichick even getting the head coaching opportunity at the New England Patriots. And so I would, in the same way we look at the New England Patriots historically, not so much this year, where they are fully prepared, they know exactly what the other team's going to do, and they have a way in order to negate it, I would not be shocked at all if we see that. And so in that, the key for my game isn't any two players. It's Bruce Arena and in preparation for his defense dealing with and negating the threat that is Giassi Sardis. Let's move on to the Western Conference Final. This game was delayed due to the Sporting Kansas City-Minnesota game being moved, so this game is no longer on Sunday. This will be coming up this coming Monday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Seattle Sounders hosting Minnesota United FC. Rachel, what's Brian Smetzer worrying about right now?
Kevin Molino for starters. This game... And I know I've said this so many times throughout the playoffs, but this is such a wild card game. And you're probably looking at, you know, the Seattle Sounders on paper and saying, well, how could you say that? They have Nico Lodero, and they have Raul Ruiz Diaz and Jordan Morris. But like we said earlier, if Minnesota can neutralize them like FC Dallas did, then Seattle's going to run into a problem. I think that the biggest question for Seattle are definitely members of that defense. Do you stay with the hot hand and ride with Shane O'Neill? If Brad Smith is 100, you know, close to 100% healthy, do you start him over Nuhu? Do you put Kelvin Leerdam back over Alex Roldan, who has been really, really good in the playoffs and has really proven that he can be a capable starting right back in the league? And I know we'll get to this eventually, but the, you know, Austin FC is watching all this because they have an expansion draft coming up and they should be looking at Alex Roldan anyway. But I think the defense, the only non-question mark on defense right now is Yamar, because he's a starter. He's always going to be a starter. But My biggest question is, I still think you roll with Leerdam and Brad Smith over Nuhu and Alex Roldan, despite how well the younger Roldan has played in the playoffs. But Shane O'Neill has been really, really good, and he has a super hot hand right now. So the question is, do you play Javier Arriaga? Do you play Shane O'Neill? I think that's going to be kind of an interesting topic for the Seattle Sounders. And I remember one of the first matches when Seattle played Minnesota after Ozzy Alonso signed with Minnesota United was, oh, it's the mentor against the mentee, Ozzy Alonso against Christian Roldan. But I think while that's still a good battle in the midfield, I'm looking at Joao Paulo against Ozzy Alonso, because I think that's going to be such a fun matchup. It's going to be an intriguing matchup, and I can't sit here and tell you who's going to come out of that matchup. And, you know, on both sides of the goal, too, if we're talking all positions here, two really good goalkeepers. I mean, Stephen Fry has been super consistent. St. Clair has been really good for Minnesota and has kind of put himself on the map in MLS. So I think this is a wild card game. I think that Seattle is deep enough that if Morris and Ruiz Diaz and Lodero do get, you know, kind of neutralized, there are, and Shane O'Neill proved this, there are other players who can come in and score. So yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I think it's going to be fun. It's going to be a good one. And who knows? Seattle could make it to a fourth final in the last 5 years. You never know.
I'm looking at things from a Minnesota United perspective here, and I think there's two key elements. As Rachel, you talked about earlier, I think FC Dallas and a few other teams in a few games this year have shown a blueprint for how to frustrate the Seattle Sounders. So I think there's a little bit of an adaptation in terms of Minnesota actually creating opportunities for that. That's going to be a little bit more difficult because obviously they're playing on two fewer days rest. So their legs are heavier than Seattle's are. They've got to implement something tactically that's a little bit different from what they usually do, not necessarily in that they press, because normally they do press very well. We saw that in the playoff game against the Colorado Rapids and at times against Sporting Kansas City, but usually it's back line and it's defensive midfielders. So this would be them going at a Gustav Svensson and the back line, less so on Nico Lodero, who's dropped a little bit deep at times, and certainly much less than a Jordan Morris or a Raul Diaz on the ball. So that's a little bit of a tactical shift. Whether or not they'll be able to implement that and then execute it, given tired legs, less training days, playing on the road, is a good question. I think the other element is clearly the motivational component. I think, give me any other team in the Western Conference that Minnesota's playing, home or away in this game, and I think the narrative, whatever psychological mind games that Adrian Heath has been able to play in, nobody believes in us, everybody thinks the Loons are crap because of that one game against Atlanta where Naheem Demidov completely forgot how to absolutely defend, and then so that has set in stone the narrative and how everyone thinks about Minnesota United for the end of their existence, in the centuries to come. And so I think that would be gone, or at the very least diminished, or harder of a weave for him to web, or a web for him to weave, were he playing any other team other than the MLS Cup champions, who have played well against Minnesota United, who are playing at home and in a position to potentially win 3 MLS Cups in 5 years and go to a fourth final in 5 years. So I think there's a key psychological component of, well, we're playing the Big Bad Sounders, so of course everybody has us as an underdog. Nobody believes in us. We're able to spin that. Is he able to do that enough motivationally? And then also, what is he doing from a position standpoint? We know Molino and Reynoso are going to be two of the three in the 4-2-3-1. We know it's probably going to be Ozzie Alonso, since he was able to start the last game and go 72 minutes, so I presume that he'd be able to at least start and go as long in their one. We'll probably see Jan Gregoos, but then do you go Kai Kamara up top, given the backline situation for Minnesota, and try to lump long balls into him? Does that move Robin Lode into the midfield where he's a little bit more mobile and able to press? How they do that from a personnel standpoint, I think, is an interesting and difficult question for Adrian Heath to have an immediate, obvious answer. Whereas I think it was much more clear in terms of how FC Dallas would go about doing that from a tactical standpoint. But I think their defensive structure is going to be okay. I think they'll be able to the extent that someone can contain Raul Ruiz Diaz, they'll be able to do that. My bigger concern is, can Ozzie Alonso cover ground and press at times Nico Lodero, Raul Ruiz Diaz for 90 minutes, potentially 120 minutes? And then similarly, how do they do that and still have enough energy for when they do create those turnovers to be able to move the ball quickly and have Reynoso set up a Robin Lud, a Kai Kamara, a Kevin Molino for a fantastic goal that comes out of nowhere? How they're able to do that on 2 days rest, playing against a team that arguably is the best of the four teams left, where this is the time in which they turn it on, I think is an interesting test. But maybe that just further proves, oh, it's a big test, we can't actually do it, nobody believes in us, Adrian Heath lights a fire under hot boy, and the hottest boy becomes the hottest goat boy. Dan, what's the next level above that from your headline the other day?
I'm trying to think. Maybe like Lit Boy?
Lit Boy? Like Sun Boy? Like he's the
I
sun?
I like Lit Boy.
Just
Lit
Boy. Sun Boy would be good too, but Lit Boy, Sun Boy sounds good.
Okay, yeah. Something.
And it rolls with Dan's theme from earlier about the light show, so.
Okay, yes. Like the, so I guess Dan, I guess the goal for Adrian Heath is to give a couple of basic tactical ideas to, show the game film against FC Dallas and then set things up such that Minnesota United is that Christmas tree Run DMZ cacophony Christmas acid trip, such that Minnesota United is able to be that to Seattle Sounders, which will be a difficult test, but maybe that'll just further prove that we should start believing in the Loons, because nobody believes that they can actually execute that. Dan, I will throw it to you. What is your key to this game?
Robin Lod versus the Minnesota United back, or versus the Seattle Sounders back line. I hope he's not going against his own back line. I think that's the biggest thing. I'm trying to recall. I don't know if any other team in the Western Conference plays with a tricky false nine kind of a player that has played the Seattle Sounders to this point. And I think, if you look at at this point, what Minnesota does is tricky. Robin Law drops deep, pulls guys out of position. Synthetic Kevin Molino is a quote winger. That's not really real. I'd even argue at this point, Ethan Finley's not much of a winger. It's very odd kind of what they'll end up doing. At times they even kind of turn into like a 3-4-3, with Finley and Molino pinched in centrally next to Laud, who's dropping deep and pulling guys out of play. If that Seattle Sounders back line gets too wide, I think that's going to be a lot of problems. So for me, I actually think Robin Laud is the key to the rhythm and the passing, and the connection that happens that leads to Bebe Lodoronoso playing in, Kevin Molino and Ethan Finley and even Robin Laud at times for, those through balls into the channels. But it all starts with Robin Laud's movement off the ball and, incoming to receive passes in the initial buildup into the final third. So for me, it's how does Shane O'Neill and how does, Yamar do that? Both of them, Yamar especially, can be a pretty aggressive center back, although he's not aggressive with significant failure on the back end like Xavier, like Arriaga normally is. And Shane O'Neill's a bit more of a stay-at-home guy. But still, Shane O'Neill is as good as he's been this year. I don't think he's quite the level of defender that can handle the type of movement and the fluid attacking in tight space combination play that Minnesota can have. But I think that the Robin Laud and how the center back pairing handles Laud in this game is going to kind of dictate whether or not the Sounders can get out on the break, because I think if they can handle that, sorry, I'm going into my own stuff. I think if the Sounders can handle that, they certainly have enough capability and firepower to finish off the chances that they will get in this game. But it's a matter of can they handle what Minnesota's going to throw at them, because Minnesota is a much better team than Dallas, and Dallas gave them some struggles there. So I am curious to see this matchup, but I really do think it's going to come down to Robin Laud versus Shane O'Neill and Yamar Gomez Andrade.
Rachel.
I think the biggest highlight on the pitch for me is really going to depend on who starts in that right back spot. Yeah, I agree with Dan. I think Arriaga is probably going to, I think he's going to start over Shane O'Neill. And Alex Roldan has been playing really, really well in the playoffs. He really has. Kelvin Leardham's probably, in my opinion, the most consistent player, aside from Stephen Fry, on the Seattle Sounders team. I think he has always just been really good on defense. He can score. He can make chances. He's a very good right back. And I really think the key matchup, Robin Laud is the guy to watch for Minnesota. But for me, it's really who's going to play that right back spot for the Sounders. And I think that's going to be a big thing to look at. It's going to be a tough game. Like I said, this is a total wild card game. I'm excited, ready for chaos.
Okay, for me, guys, I think it comes down to, as I was talking about earlier in my breakdown, just what is the physical ability of Ozzie Alonso. He's obviously very familiar with, each of the key attacking players for Seattle Sounders. Again, playing on the road, having to take a charter flight the day before or the day of this game, playing on 2 days fewer rest in a game in which he only played 72 minutes. How much of that was Ozzie building up his fitness or not wanting to be exhausted versus it's 3-0 in the 72nd minute? Let's see if we can see this game out and save out my holding mid for potentially having to play 120 minutes on Sunday or on Monday, excuse me. So I think that's the key for me. Where is Ozzie Alonso in terms of his legs and his fitness and just his ability to execute covering space, given the things that Minnesota are going to have to do if Seattle is able to deal with that, if Nicolò Daro, if the Roldans playing out of the back are able to break out of that press, then that is going to need gaps to cover up for them. So that's where Ozzie Alonso, again, ironically, in his time for Seattle, where he was a real talisman and where he was absolutely at his best and most valuable, he is going to have to be that in those 5, 10, 15-ish moments that will occur on Monday, and if he's able to be at the same level that he was at, you know, even just a couple of years ago when he was, for my money, the best number six in all of MLS, then I think Minnesota has a really good opportunity. But I think if that's not the case, or he's not able to cover, or those key attackers, Morris, Rui Diaz, one of the right backs overlapping, for example, are able to execute, then we could see a scenario, maybe not in the game, but in individual moments where Seattle does to Minnesota what Minnesota has done in the last two games to Sporting Kansas City and Colorado Rapids. That does it for us with all of our breakdowns. We'll go to the roundtable and then get to predictions. So first of all, Rachel, I will throw it to you. If all reports are indicating true, I think Joey Saputo's done the only one last unpopular thing that he could do, and that is the Montreal Impact changing their name to Montreal FC and thus robbing me and Dan, Rachel, of our soccer dad jokes of Brace for Impact.
Okay, for Dan, it's totally credible because he's a dad, but Matt, what are you doing? I think it's just, you know, I'll save that for off the air. You know I love
Matt's excuse is that he's a nerd.
Okay, yeah, Matt's excuse is that he's a nerd. That's totally fair.
When you give up a goal in the last minute, it has to be due to very spurious defending from Tottenham.
Okay, put his mic on mute for the rest of the show. He's done. He's done.
We need that, like, canned Stewie laughter of, like, the...
Yes.
So many Family Guy references tonight. There's, like, no uniqueness anymore, guys, with these names. I mean, there's too many dang Uniteds. There's too many Fs. I get it. We want to be, like, Europe. We want to be fancy. I appreciate that when the Houston Dynamo rebranded, they were like, we'll slap on FC, but we're not just going to be Houston FC. We're going to be Houston Dynamo FC. Whatever. Nobody cares about the FC anyway. But for Montreal... I mean, the Impact was such, like, it wasn't the greatest name. It wasn't the fanciest name, but it was a good name, and it was unique.
But it was unique.
Yes, it was unique, and it was fun, and it made sense, right? I mean, it wasn't just Montreal FC, Montreal SC. Like, Montreal freaking United at this point. There's, like, it's sad that there's really no unique, some of these cities could have really, like, I remember when Charlotte was getting their expansion stuff together, like, Charlottetown would have been awesome, and now they're, what is it, Charlotte SC or, like, FC or something like that?
Charlotte FC.
Yeah, Charlotte FC, it sucks. We need some more creativity. Like, these people need to hire. I don't care if y'all gotta hire somebody and pay them like $100,000. Hire me and pay me $100,000. I'll come up with a cool name for you.
Okay. I'm gonna go with Montreal Impact. I'll check in the mail, please, Joey Saputo there. No, I guess my biggest issue with it is, like, it's completely abandoning, like, the history behind that team, which is the thing that I think, you know, is extremely disturbing for me. I think one of the things that a lot of teams in MLS have done a good job of is hearkening back to their past history. I think there are distinct ties, Rachel, in terms of some of the branding and the way they went about bringing back the Sounders into existence, into the NASL, and then obviously into MLS. And I feel like you're removing that, especially if we see a full rebrand in the form of, you know, a complete new crest that doesn't have the Florida Lee from the Montreal Impact, Montreal FC, or if we see even abandonment of the blue and black colors, then I think you're divorcing yourself from the history and a lot of the culture that exists around that team. But speaking of teams that have realized that their culture is an issue or that their branding was wrong and ultimately upset the fans, the Chicago Fire are potentially looking at back and going back and changing the crest that they actually have from the – this is going to sound weird, folks. One of my friends from St. Louis, a member of the St. Luligans, like, saw that new crest, the pointy going away from the Fire logo, and immediately said, those things look like Klan hats, and ever since that moment, I can't unsee it. So I see the Chicago Fire crest, and as opposed to seeing, like, the pointy, like, I see the pointy triangles, and I'm like, that's KKK hat. So that's not good. Not that that's in any way associated with the rebrand of the Chicago Fire, but credit to them on, albeit a year later than they should have, realizing that this wasn't something that was going to work, was something that was weird, that was not well received in the public ire, and ultimately went away from a lot of the history that the club had. Whether or not they revert back to the old crest that they had, or just an updated version, which I would totally be okay with, I think that at the very least is a step in the right direction. It's disappointing that an MLS team with a lot of history, a lot of tradition, and everything going back to 1997 took an entire year to realize this, when the premier team in the USL Championship realized it an hour after they sent the initial tweet about the revamp of the crest logo. I am, of course, subtweeting Louisville City FC. Dan, I will throw it to you initially. We've got a bunch of coaching carousel. What's going on, and which one of the seven headlines that are out there right now do you want to talk about?
Yeah, there's a lot. So first off, Greg Vanney left. He's most likely going to the LA Galaxy. Shocked? No, not me. Not I, said. I don't even know. I don't have any. I'm like worn out of like puns and witty things at this point. Yeah, it would make total sense for Greg Vanney to replace Greg Berhalter, GBS. I don't know. There's a lot of G's and B's and crap. Guillermo Barrasoloto for the LA Galaxy. I won't totally steal. I'll give Matt credit for these talking points, but I'm just gonna say them. I am impressed with he's the perfect fit for a team that one knows how to get international players in, but also has completely misused the MLS market with all of the people that they have had in the past. They haven't been able to capitalize on the MLS market since they had Bruce Arena in charge of that team. And I think that right there is kind of been their downfall in recent years. Some of these teams that are left over have utilized the MLS market incredibly well. Chris Armas seems like he's going to be the hands down replacing Ben Olsen in DC. Ben Olsen has also been linked to the Toronto FC coaching vacancy now that is out, that Greg Vinny is there, which bash your head into the wall if you want to. Already covered LA Galaxy and Greg Vanney. The last one is Atlanta United, the crown jewel of all the coaching jobs at this point. I mean, Toronto FC is a pretty good gig, but I'd say Atlanta at this point, with the money, the investment, the stadium, the fans, and stuff like that, Atlanta United is left over as a team that is needing a head coach, and they will be getting the best of all these candidates, possibly, in Gabriel Heinze, who, if you know, had a pretty illustrious career at playing in Europe for across a few of the major teams there. Argentinian left back, very, very good coach, coached up a Vélez Sarsfield team that has since sold off a lot of their studs. Heinze coached a Vélez team that had a lot of really good talent, young talent, in their mid-20s and early teens that he was able to bring up that has eventually been sold off. I'm sure you've heard of, if you follow the European game, you've heard of Thiago Almada, who's been a very, very good player. I believe the player that came to Gaston Rodriguez or something like that. There was an Argentinian player that came to the Chicago Fire this offseason. That he was center midfielder that came from Vélez Sarsfield, also very good. A lot of good players have come from Vélez Sarsfield at this point. Even down in Argentina, they tend to filter out into Boca and River Plate and some of the larger teams there. But under Heinze, this is one of the best teams in the Argentinian Premier League, a consistent threat in the Copa Libertadores. He fell out of favor there. The contract dispute, money is not good in Argentina right now. So this is an ideal, this is a one I've been pounding the desk for Atlanta to snap up like the moment they fired Frank DeBoer. And I'm excited that it seems like Atlanta are going to be landing the big fish in Gabriel Heinze. We'll be curious to see who he's bringing along, because there's a rumor that he's bringing an assistant who's also the current slash maybe former manager of Vélez Sarsfield, and also a very big soccer name. Emmanuel Giglio.
Before we hit the record button, Dan, we were talking about Greg Vanney potentially to the LA Galaxy. You took a lot of my talking points. I guess the one thing that I'll add, I think one thing that's been really missing from this organization, I think Joe Tutino, the main TV color commentator alongside Kobe Jones in a game, I think it was the home loss to the San Jose Earthquakes, but I can't remember because there were so many bad losses for the LA Galaxy this year. They kind of all blend together, where just the fight and the energy and the effort had really lost. And you can kind of tell that the players were checked out. They weren't, you know, reacting to anything that GBS was doing. And Tatino said, this isn't, like, this isn't in the spirit of the shirt or the crest. I'm sorry. And so I think, you know, your points on Greg Vanney make him all a slam dunk. But I think being a former player, understanding what that club used to mean and the significance and the standards that were there in the early 2000s when they were challenging and trying to win their first MLS Cup in the 2010s, albeit Vanney had moved on at that point, I think that's something that's needed. And that's something that people from the outside coming in, like they, you know, I think Dennis DeGlosa and GBS come in and all their initial knowledge of the club from a culture standpoint is, oh, this is the club of major European stars, they win trophies. But kind of understanding how to connect that to, from an effort, from an attention to detail standpoint, that Bruce Arena did so well is something that Greg Vanney would bring. And really understanding it from an emotional standpoint, and especially as someone who's come, who's been in MLS and has kind of seen the evolution and the swing of the teeter-totter with LAFC coming in, understands the significance of the challenge, how the club was able to get there in the past, and how to do that in the future. I think that's the one kind of other ingredient that hasn't really been missing that Greg Vanney would be able to bring as a guy who's won MLS Cups, as a guy who played for the LA Galaxy, who's seen what's happened to them. You know, is kind of the other element that's been missing from the organization that Greg Vanney would fill, in addition to the domestic, institutional, and idiosyncratic knowledge that clearly DTK and GBS were missing at times this year. Rachel, anything else you want to say about the coaching carousel, or shall we head to predictions?
I think you guys hit pretty much everything perfectly. I've always really liked Greg Vanney as a coach. I think that he's kind of like, he hypes up players without being super, like, over-exuberant and stuff. Like, he's not like your rah-rah type of guy, but I think that he just has that, like Matt said, like, he's a former player, he's got the personality. So I think, you know, if the rumors are true and everything falls into place, I think he would be a great fit for the Galaxy.
Last thing, Rachel, since it just popped in my brain, Brian Smetzer still playing on a contract that's about to expire. I mean, even if Seattle doesn't win anything, like, is there any scenario where Seattle doesn't give him whatever he wants in order to stay with the organization?
I mean, I'll give him my soul if he wants it. It really all depends. I mean, yeah, you gotta give the man what he deserves. Pay the guy. I feel like, I don't know, just from knowing, quote unquote, knowing Brian and everything, he doesn't seem like the guy that's like, you gotta give me like hundreds of thousands of dollars. I feel like he wants to stay in Seattle. Like, his whole, he's a Seattle guy through and through. Played for the indoor team, I think. He has a huge family, and his family's all in Seattle. So he's Seattle through and through. So I really think that everybody just needs to put their heads together in Seattle, give that man what he wants. I don't care if it's like the prettiest, nicest office, better than all of the 12,000 owners that they have. Give it to him.
I think similar things could be said of a certain well-tempered ginger in Chester, Pennsylvania. But in any case, let us get on to predictions here, folks. We will start chronologically with the Eastern Conference Final. Columbus Crew SC hosting the New England Revolution. This will be this coming Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on ABC. Dan, who you got? Why? What's the score line? How many minutes does it take?
I'm going to take New England 2-1, 90 minutes.
Rachel.
I'm going to take Columbus. Same score line, but extra time.
I will take Columbus by a score of 1-0 in 90 minutes. I think Giosi's artist will be largely negated, but I think in terms of just individual quality, Lucas Zelarayán is the best player in the 11 for either team, and ultimately he will shine against Scott Caldwell, whereas I think Archer is a better matchup against Carlos Gil and Gustavo Bo. We will then head on to the Western Conference Final, Seattle Sounders hosting Minnesota United FC this coming Monday, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on FS1. Dan, who you got and why?
Minnesota United 2-1. Hot Boy and Bebe Lorenoso are going to steal the show. I don't know if the Sounders have played a team that is as complete and as good as Minnesota have been recently. This is a Minnesota United team that absolutely shredded FC Dallas multiple times towards the end of the season in the current form that they are in. And this is a Seattle Sounders team that struggled with FC Dallas at home. I think Minnesota United will be in a good position to pull this off. I think what they do fits well against what the Seattle Sounders have troubles with.
Rachel?
2-0. Seattle Sounders. 90 minutes.
I will take, I'll take 2-1 in 90 minutes to Seattle Sounders. Major League MLS Cup playoffs are a very simple game. 22 men kick a soccer ball around for an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes a little bit longer, and at the end, Rave Green always wins. All right, we will. That is us. It for our episode. So I guess the one thing that I will say, folks, since this will be our last podcast before the games actually happen, and then by then we will know who is playing and where they are playing in the MLS Cup Final 2020. Let us go on to last words. Rachel, I will throw it to you first. Do you have any last words? Where can people find you on Twitter?
I really don't have many last words. I think I'm all ranted out. I save all my women's arguments pretty much to make people angry at Equalizer. I don't know. So yeah, I'm on Twitter at Rachel Kruger. I'll be covering the Sounders game, probably watching and, you know, enjoying soccer on Sunday. So feel free to chat with me about things and stuff and Brian Schmetzer's awesomeness.
Dan, last words, social media platforms, and Icarus FC.
Folks, are you tired of the same old uniforms and cookie-cutter templates from Nike and Adidas? Are you looking for a unique, completely custom kit for your youth club, Sunday league squad, adult, or even pro team? Icarus FC can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price. With the motto, any design you want, seriously. Let them help you design your new custom kit today at IcarusFC.com. My last words. A bunch of you boneheads in the Sporting Kansas City fandom think it's a good idea that Peter Vermes should be on the hot seat and should be fired. Slightly understand hot seat, maybe, I guess, I don't know. I haven't won a trophy in 3 seasons now, so I guess we should all be, worried that they're not achieving one of their, you know, their annual goal of winning all 3 trophies. However, let's be real here. I put it to someone that I do really respect who raised the question of, you know, I do think you should, they raised the point that they felt for me, should be on the hot seat a little bit. And if the club is to continue to hold itself to the expectations that it does. My point was that Sir Alex Ferguson did not win jack crap from 2003 to 2007 at Manchester United. If you fire him after the 2005-2006 season, you don't get what happens from even after the 2006-2007 season, you do not get all of the goodness that happens from 2007 to 2013 for Manchester United. I really do caution fans that, you know, Sporting Kansas City, this year was, at the start of the year, was a bit of a rebuild. They brought in a couple of very significant pieces to be at the top of that team. They ended up working in a lot of the homegrowns into this that got some valuable experience this year. But in reality, you know, with the pandemic in the middle of all of this crap, this is a team that did not have their best player, their number 10, outside of their best player not named Don Pulido for the entire season of itself, and did not get Pulido down the stretch, did not get Gattikindo down the stretch. They didn't have Graham Zusi down the stretch. So I think there's a lot to this team that, there's a lot of building blocks for the future that were meant to come out this season as part of the plan for Mises bringing along a lot of the homegrown talents. And there's some really good pieces that are going to be in the middle of their prime for the next couple of years that will definitely be here for the coming seasons. And I think there's still a bit of a build to a year where, like, 2018 was like the year where they All the chips were in. Before the season even started, it was, we're not done yet. We're winning more trophies. We got to get going. That has not been a theme for Sporting Kansas City for a while now. Why? Because they knew that that was the pinnacle. That's where a lot of big players left, and a lot of their core was at the end of their prime. Now, the current core that they have slowly recycled to become the current core is going to be in the middle of their prime for the next couple of years. And this is a chance for Sporting Kansas City to retool the last couple of years as they have. And sure, they finished on top of the West. They had very high expectations to win it all. And that is fair. That is an organizational goal that they set out every single year. But just because they fell short of that goal for the last couple of years of winning a trophy in general should not mean that we are getting ready to throw Peter Vermees to the wolves. I mean, DC United held on to Ben Olsen for a decade and won maybe two trophies, I think, at one trophy in a decade. And we're talking about getting rid of a manager because he hasn't won a trophy in 3 years, despite making being first in the Western Conference in two of the last of those 3 years for the regular season. Let's be real here. I know we're upset after what happened last night, and rightfully so, but get a grip. Come back to reality. Oh, there goes gravity. I'm going to stop with the M&M lyrics, but that's my final thoughts. I mean, folks, just chill. Let's chill on the idea that Peter Vermees should be on the hot seat. If they were to not make playoffs in the next couple of years, sure. There's a very baseline, like, level of, like, goodness that you have to make playoffs, and it's not very high. If Vermees isn't punching there, then sure. But the dude went from 11th to 1st in the middle of a pandemic without a majority of their best players. Let's cool it.
All right, for my last word, as much promised for you, Rachel, I'm here to present my 2020 Major League Soccer All Chaos Best 11. Rachel, should I start at top with the forwards or in back in goal?
Well, you have to start at goal.
Okay, in goal, we're playing a proper 3-5-2 in my formation because not only do we appreciate outside backs, we appreciate chaotic center backs. So in any case, in goal, he's capable of single-handedly winning you a playoff game and kickstarts drunk MLS by not remembering that he has hands. It's the Portland Timbers' Steve Clark. At right center back, we have a bleached blonde-tipped center back who also takes PKs because nobody else can score penalties for his team. It's Rito Ziegler. At central center back, at his peak, he's able to be a defender of the year caliber center back. At his worst, he will make Greg Vanney say the F word 7 times in 1 half. It's Omar Gonzalez. At left center back, I don't know what's going on with his hairline. He was fantastic for Atlanta, decided he was out, and then decided to come back to MLS for more chaos. It's Leonardo Gonzalez Pires. At right wing back, he's able to get an assist and get a, you know, 7.0 on his player rating for a game, or he'll get an immediate red card. It's Julian Araujo. At defensive midfielder, the king of CONCACAFing, Portland Timbers, Diego Chará. At, I guess, left attacking central midfielder, probably the most emotional and in-your-face designated player we've ever had, it's Orlando City's Nani. At right center attacking midfielder, it's the best player in the history of Philadelphia Union. Why his number is not retired and why he doesn't have a statue outside Subaru Park is beyond me. It's El Seno. At left wing back, this player for the Seattle Sounders is single-handedly capable of being the best player on the counterattack and single-handedly being the only reason they don't score on the counterattack. In one play, it's Nuhu Tolo. And then up top, we have a man who will score with his face and know nothing about it, score an absolute golazo, but then miss two sitters in the same game. It's Yossi Zardes. And then at the other forward position, the captain of Team Chaos, the man of stoppage time who does not give up, who's about to turn 42 years old in the next 5 minutes and will not be stopped, especially in the 9th minute of 7 minutes allowed stoppage time. It's Chris Wondolowski. Dan, Rachel, what do you think of my All Chaos Best 11?
I'm okay with it. I do think center back chaos, I'm surprised Kendall Watson isn't in there. Is he single-handedly capable of scoring a brace and starting a full-blown brawl all within one stroke. So that would have been a.
He's also getting phased out. Like I picked regular. I picked regular starters because I mean, for all of the wrong reasons. If I wanted to pick a true chaos person, like I feel like I can't even remember. Alexander Katai would have been a good one for all of the wrong reasons, obviously. So I distinctly wanted to go with guys who are starters, who I expect to be starters, regularly playing next year as well. Rachel, your thoughts?
I swear to God, if you're the reason why New Who scores against Minnesota United, I'm flying to Denver just to look at you and shake my head at you, and then flying back to Pittsburgh.
Rachel, you better bring a Seattle Sounders New Who Tolo jersey for me as well.
Duh.
I would, of course, that'd be maybe the one scenario in which I could actually find myself wearing a Sounders jersey. So let's see.
I will bring my Kelvin Leardom jersey, and we can just be outside back buddies.
Okay, that sounds fun. Okay, listeners, I want to thank our other sponsor, Roughneck Scarves. They are an official purveyor of MLS, USL, and US soccer merchandise. They're also making net gaiters and masks as well, both generic ones, some with some patterns, some soccer and team-specific theme, and also available for customization as well. So you get your custom scarf, net gaiter, mask, etc. for your group, team, or office at roughneckscarves.com. Follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Follow us across all social media platforms at LastWordSC. And check out all of our content, MLS Cup playoffs, or otherwise related at lastwordonsports.com/soccer. Rate, review, subscribe, share, unsubscribe, wherever you get your podcast. Just search LWS Radio. You'll find us and a bunch of other great stuff. Listeners, the next time we talk to you, it'll be the week of MLS Cup.